It is my honor to introduce to you Father Thomas Joseph White, who will be speaking to us on The Church in the Postmodern World, Gaudium et Spes on Nature and Grace. Father Thomas Joseph professed his solemn vows as a Dominican friar in 2007 and was ordained to the priesthood in 2008. An undergraduate at Brown University, he went on to earn a master's and a doctorate from Oxford University, as well as a license of sacred theology from this pontifical faculty, where he is presently an associate professor of systematic theology and the director of the Thomistic Institute. Father Thomas Joseph has distinguished himself and the school through his significant contribution to the renewal of Thomistic theology in the English-speaking world. His publications include the following books: Wisdom in the Face of Modernity, A Study in Thomistic Natural Theology; The Incarnate Lord, A Study in Thomistic Christology, which is forthcoming from the Catholic University of America Press; in the edited books Divine Impassibility and the Mystery of Human Suffering, The Analogy of Being, Invention of the Antichrist or Wisdom of God, and Aquinas and Bart, An Unofficial Ecumenical Dialogue. He's now working on another book manuscript, Exodus, A Theological Commentary, under contract with Brazos Press. Father Thomas Joseph has about 30 essays in such academic journals as The Thomist, Novet Vetera, and Pro Ecclesia, and in many scholarly book collections. He is an associate editor of The Thomist and Novet Vetera, an ordinary academician of the Pontifical Academy of St. Thomas Aquinas, and a prominent figure in the Academy of Catholic Theology. The list of accomplishments in natural theology, Christology, the theology of grace, sacramental theology, and the ecumenical dialogue called for by the Second Vatican Council goes on and on. On a personal note, I want to express my deep admiration not only for his prodigious theological contributions, but also for his contribution to fraternity. His work has elevated those of us who collaborate with him in various special conferences that he organizes, and even more, those of us who live, pray, and study with him here at the Dominican House of Studies. As Master of Students, I can say that his contribution to the formation of our student brothers, in ways both public and hidden, is inestimable for their preparation to be preachers of grace in our world so in need of God's healing. I will miss him as he goes to Oxford for a sabbatical this academic year. Without further ado, please give a hearty welcome to the one who has been acclaimed the King of Brookland Thomism, Father Thomas Joseph White!
Since just until that last line of demagogy, that was the nicest thing anyone has said about me ever, I think we should stop now before I give any opinions and ruin that wonderful set of, I hope, not entire exaggerations, but probably. Okay. Gaudium et Spes was composed in order to present Christianity to the modern world, setting forth a theological vision of man in light of Christ. But everyone can ask themselves, honestly, how contemporary is this document today, in light of all the important changes that have occurred since its publication? We might think here most notably of the 1989 fall of communism, the political triumph of capitalist liberalism, the wide-scale secularization of Europe and North America, the growth of Christianity in the global South, the influence of postmodern theory on ontology and ethics, the very important sexual revolution and its effects, the discovery of the human genome, the rise of militant Islam, the widespread crisis of Catholic religious orders, and the cultural transformation enacted by modern social media, especially through the use of the computer and the internet, and the way it changes the perceptions of the church and its personnel. None of these events were foreseen by the Council, and all these events are more central to the culture of the 21st century than many of the signs of the times alluded to in Gaudium et Spes as conditioning the church in the modern world. Consequently, we may ask fairly, 50 years after its publication, if despite all intentions to the contrary, the document has any unambiguous relevance to the church in the postmodern world. In fact, the core idea of Gaudium et Spes is, I will argue in this paper, quite relevant to us today, even if this is the case under circumstances the authors did not envisage. For at the heart of the document is the notion that grace can so transform the human condition by charity, and does so, that we may only fully understand what man is, and even what the natural law is, most plainly and most adequately in the light of Christ. Christ is the source of any true humanism. That's the core theme of the document. The idea is articulated there with a great deal of optimism, but we can also reread today with a pertinent mix of Augustinian sobriety this same principle. Grace does have the power to redeem human culture, and the church alone can truly promote an authentic humanism. But human culture without grace is wounded with respect even to the natural goods of human flourishing. A culture that forsakes Christ may also become a culture that loses sight of what it is to be human. For the church to live with the twin realism these principles accord is to live as a city on a hill or a light to the nations, a lumen gentium. But also for the church to live as a stranger in a strange land. And we need to keep both these notions close at hand. So let me begin by talking about Christocentricism, grace, and nature. Section 22 presents the essential Christological vision of Gaudium et Spes. The location is quite significant. Paragraphs 12 through 621 set out a fundamental theological anthropology, treating subjects such as the human being made in the image of God, the reality of sin, the essential nature of man as body and spiritual soul, the dignity of the human intellect, conscience, and moral freedom, the mystery or enigma of death, and various forms of atheism. Now, the affirmations made in that document on all these subjects are all controversial today. It's not at all evident, you could argue publicly, that man is made in the image of God any more than you could argue easily, publicly, that human marriage is by definition heterosexual. The teachings here are comprised from a mixture of experiential observations regarding the human condition, but also scholastic philosophy and a lot of references to biblical teaching. They present the human being as possessing a nature oriented towards spiritual transcendence, but as simultaneously wounded by acute forms of moral and physical misery, sort of Pascal, the greatness and misery of man. The presentation of Christology is therefore apologetic as well as analytic. Christ helps us to decrypt the enigmatic quality of human existence. The presupposition is that the human condition cannot be fully explained by natural reason alone, and we must have recourse to the revelation given in Jesus Christ. There are two dimensions to this claim. One is formal or essential, and the other teleological. Christ reveals man to himself essentially because he is perfect man. Without the mystery of Jesus, it's difficult to see perfectly well what the human being is. Meanwhile, Christ illumines the mystery of the human condition teleologically because the human heart is so structured that its desires tend objectively toward beatitude or ultimate happiness, which is truly found in God alone. And only in the grace of Christ does this desire find its existentially adequate rest. To quote from Gaudium et Spes 22, Christ, the final Adam, by the revelation of the mystery of the Father and his love, fully reveals man to man himself and makes his supreme calling clear, the teleological. It is not surprising, then, that in him all the aforementioned truths find their root and attain their crown, everything that's been talked about in terms of anthropology in the previous eight sections. He who is the image of the invisible God is himself perfect man, true God and true man. Note then that Christ, who is both God and man, reveals the human being's nature in its originally intended integrity, not affected by sin, but whole and entire, subject to God and at the service of the authentic love of other human beings. In the 13th century, Catholic theologians differed on the question of whether angels and men were first created in a state of grace, or whether they were first created in a state of pure nature, that's to say, absent the gift of grace, and offered grace only subsequently. Aquinas argued for the former position, original creation in grace. And the council clearly suggests that man was meant to be from the beginning in a historical state of grace. Human beings existing without grace, then, exist in a wounded or incomplete state, not naturally or formally incomplete in the sense that, by sin we cease to be human, essentially, but rather affected in their mode of being as regards their true end, which is found in God alone. Christ has essentially the same nature as Adam, who is wounded by the consequences of sin, but Christ possesses this nature in a restored, sinless state or mode. That's why we see best what we are best called, what we're called to be as human beings by looking at Christ, not because sinners cease to be human beings essentially, but because that we live as, due to sin in a wounded state or mode, and in Christ we see a plenary restoration of what it means to be human. Just as grace does not destroy human nature but heals and elevates it, so the human life Jesus possesses is more naturally perfect because it is free from sin and is the most perfectly graced human life. Grace makes us more ourselves in the order of nature. We should note the explicit universality of the teaching under consideration. And this, what I'm about to say here, coheres absolutely, profoundly with what Rusty Reno was saying yesterday about triumphant inclusivism. Gaudium et Spes 22 states, "By his incarnation, the Son of God has united himself in some fashion with every man." Here we touch upon the question of the extension of the grace of Christ, and the document could not be more explicit, and this is the only long quote I'm going to give, but I'm going to read the whole thing. "The Christian man, conformed to the likeness of that Son who is the firstborn of many brothers, received the first fruits of the Spirit, by which he becomes capable of discharging the new law of love. Pressing upon the Christian, to be sure, are the need and the duty to battle against evil through manifold tribulations and even to suffer death. But linked with the paschal mystery and patterned on the dying Christ, he, the Christian, will hasten forward to resurrection in the strength which comes from hope." Now here's the key part. "All this holds true, not only for Christians, but for all men of goodwill, in whose hearts grace works in an unseen way. For since Christ died for all men, and since the ultimate vocation of man is in fact one and divine," that's the supernatural calling to the beatific vision, "we ought to believe that the Holy Spirit, in a manner known to God, offers to every man the possibility of being associated with this paschal mystery." Widest possible universal extension of Christocentric inclusive triumphalism. So here we come to the heart of the matter. The grace of Christ is at work in the world in hidden ways, even outside the visible life of the church, the Catholic Church, and the sacraments. This teaching is grounded, this teaching of Gaudium et Spes is grounded in the theology of early modernity, formulated in controversies with the Protestant reformers as well as the Jansenist theologians of the 17th century. For at the Council of Trent, the Catholic Church clarified against affirmations of John Calvin and Martin Luther that the grace of Christ, the grace of God can be offered to human beings who refuse or resist it, thus reiterating a biblical notion and a traditional teaching of medieval Catholic theology. And in the Jansenist controversy, the idea was taken a step further in logically organic fashion. Christ has died for all human beings, against the Augustinus of Jansen, and consequently all human beings are offered the possibility of salvation by the hidden workings of the grace of God down through history. If some human beings are not saved, this is not because they were not offered the grace that could lead them to salvation, but because they refused or resisted this grace culpably. It's important to have the idea that grace could be resisted, because then you can hold the universalism and still accept the reality that there's a lot of resistance to the light. What the council does is interpret this traditional teaching in a newly social, dynamic, and historical way. The grace of Christ is at work in the whole historical sweep of human life and society. Just as our human nature is not meant to exist outside of the sphere of a relationship with God in the order of grace, so concrete history is a place where fallen human nature is perpetually affected in concrete ways by the hidden presence and work of grace. Now, the thinking in this text in Gaudium et Spes is profoundly ecclesiocentric. Its necessary parallel text is Lumen Gentium 14 through 16. There, in Lumen Gentium, we find the ancient dictum, "No salvation outside the church." No salvation exists outside the church. That's reaffirmed. It's uttered in Lumen Gentium, but also then rearticulated positively All those who are saved by the grace of Christ, and therefore in some kind of direct relationship, imperfect membership, eventual full incorporation into the visible Catholic Church, whether in this life or the next, and thus the Catholic destiny of all humanity. The teaching of Lumen Gentium then goes on to draw a set of concentric circles around the visible Catholic Church as so many exterior ripples where the grace of Christ might, conditionally, might be present throughout the historical and social sphere of human culture, first in the Eastern Orthodox churches, then in the Protestant ecclesial communities, then in non-Christian monotheists, Jews, and then Muslims, and in other religious traditions, Hinduism, Buddhist wisdom traditions, and the various spheres of secular humanism, where human beings genuinely seek to find the truth and accomplish the moral good, perhaps in response to the hidden action of the grace of Christ. The presupposition is that the fullness of the means of salvation are found uniquely in the visible communion of the Catholic Church, but that elements of Catholic sacramental life and teaching can be found in different degrees in communities, cultures, and individuals outside the visible Catholic Church. Grace can be operative in those domains of human society in ways that are more seemingly evident or more hidden. Now, it must be noted that the teaching of Lumen Gentium does not ignore the real possibility of eternal damnation that threatens each human being, and it clearly intimates that this danger exists more concretely the more the person is estranged from the ordinary means of salvation that are to be found in the visible Catholic Church, her teaching, and her sacraments. It's easier to be saved if you practice full incorporation into the means given by the Catholic Church. It's easier to be eternally damned the further you are from those means. But God makes use of the means that exist outside the Catholic Church, often allied with the invincible ignorance of the persons in question. It follows from the principles of grace and nature mentioned above that the presentation of the natural law given in Gaudium et Spes must be complex. The Council does appeal unambiguously to a wide variety of principles drawn from the natural law, as well as the overarching notion of the universal natural law, mentioning several times. I read an essay by Schillebeck saying, natural law is never mentioned once in Gaudium et Spes, and so I did the computer word search and found all the times it is mentioned explicitly. He was an expert paritus. Anyway. What this means is that there is no profound discord or methodological inconsistency in the teaching of Gaudium et Spes. I mean, why? On the one hand, grace enlightens the whole human cosmos and makes it clear what it means to be human. On the other hand, there is such a thing as natural law rationally accessible to all human beings. Is that contradictory? The document enunciates moral teachings regarding just war, the human family, the inviolability of human dignity, mentioning, of course, abortion famously as abominable crime, that's the language, sound principles of economic practice, the right to education, and so forth, that are considered universal and naturally accessible to human reason in ways formally distinct from revelation. It's very clear the document in many of these passages is absolutely addressing non-Christians, making claims about natural reason. The document also underscores the significance of the grace of Christ for a right understanding of the moral principles of human civilization, such that only in the light of Christ is man able to perceive fully the dignity of his moral vocation to contribute ethically to the common good. The presupposition here, if you look at the tension between these two polarities, the presupposition here is neither that non-Christians are wholly immoral. That would be an exaggerated theory of radical depravity. They're so blind, we can only wait for their conversion to Christ before we appeal to the natural law. Or that Christianity alone by divine revelation provides the premises of the natural law, an exaggerated form of revelatory positivism or practical fideism. Unless you look to the church, you can never get to anything naturally true in the ethical sphere. Right? This is all being rejected. Rather, the presupposition is that man has in his nature, as such, essential inclinations towards life and society and the moral law that remain intact in the fallen state. I said inclinations. But that these inclinations are wounded and rendered in great part non-effective due to the effects of personal and social sin. Consequently, they can only be fully awakened and effectively realized, or you might say healed, under the influences of the grace of Christ. This rendering of the human condition is not particularly novel. It seems to constitute a creative representation in a modern setting of the classical teaching of medieval and early modern Catholic scholastic literature. Aquinas himself is willing to envisage a fairly radical erosion of the true perception of the moral law in the human hearts, dimmed by sin, at least at various times and places. However, he says, the radical capacity or potency for moral awareness does remain inscribed within natural human reason even in the fallen state, and grace can act within the moral conscience to restore and heal the full scope of moral practical reasoning from the clear perception of first principles, which are virtually unavoidable, like do good and avoid evil, whatever good and evil are, to middle-term principles, never take innocent human life. It's a little more difficult. We needed a commandment at Mount Sinai to get that one kind of clear in our mind, to the extension to particular cases. Never kill innocent human life in the womb at any stage and no matter what circumstances obtain, which is a much more difficult. And it's easier to come to that when grace has really strengthened the mind and the heart. Here, then, we arrive at the question of the optimism of the document, the tone. In fact, we may speak rightly regarding Gaudium et Spes of a tale of two optimisms, which we should distinguish in the text. The fundamental optimism, I would argue, is grounded in a traditional Catholic vision of the transformative dimensions of grace articulated against the anthropological pessimism of Luther. Grace, when it is fully at work in the world, does internally heal, renew, and elevate all human actions from within, especially by the infused habit of charity, in such a way as to transform not only individuals, but the basic orientations of whole societies. The love of Christ can change the human being and can change civilization and the world. This kind of optimism has its roots in the Fathers, the Thomas Doctrine of Grace, and the teachings of the Council of Trent. It is applied by the Second Vatican Council to modern secular society in a more social and historical way, but in a manner that's arguably consonant with what has come before. The second optimism would regard the viability of promoting this vision of nature-grace integration and of Catholic humanism in the context of mid-20th century post-World War, modern secular Europe. Now, clearly the Council Fathers did aspire, optimistically, to promote an alternative vision of modern social life that would contrast both with the emergent atheist communism and with the idea of a return to the establishment Catholicism of the pre-revolutionary monarchical age. It's a third way. We're not going back behind 1789, and we're not capitulating to the communist East. This second form of optimism may have been warranted within the context of the Christian democratic socialism emergent in Germany, France, and Italy in the 1950s and 60s. Perhaps it was naive even then. Whether it was in fact or not appropriate at that age, one could argue that the grounds for such optimism of a profound church-state harmony in Europe and the Americas has largely evaporated in the last 50 years following the Council due to the intensive secularization that has taken place in those regions. I realize there's a whole lot of other people who think very differently about that, and there may even be some here, but I suspect this something may come up in the question and answer, but I think this kind of sobriety is really something thrust upon us very sharply right now. We have an administration who in certain ways wants to push the Catholic Church out of the social sphere. It's a very good illustration. In fact, the irony is that the changes that have occurred in the war since the time of the Council make it difficult to maintain publicly the very principles that the Council assumes will be grounds for social unity and a new Christian humanism. I mean, the very thing that they think is going to draw Europe together is today, in many ways, a liability. In the second half of my paper, then, let me illustrate this with two acute examples. The first concerns Christocentrism itself as a principle of social humanism. The second is marriage, which receives an extensive treatment in the document. What some council authors thought would be the basis for a new universalism become today a sign of contradiction. So let me turn to the sociological universality of Jesus. The soteriological universality of Jesus. The edifice of Gaudium et Spes stands or falls on the presupposition of its Christology and the universal applicability of the vision of grace and nature that it affords. And yet we can immediately note a central difficulty that this raises in a contemporary context. The core aspiration of post-Enlightenment modern liberalism is to create a form of government and a conception of individual and state rights that is free from any immediate dependence upon religious confessional commitments. Furthermore, in many contemporary secular governments, there's an accelerating tendency to preclude any normative public appeal to moral commitments derived even indirectly from the Christian tradition. I'm just thinking of stuff like the European Union refusing to even claim that there's a Christian heritage in the Constitution that helped form the unity of the continent, or the sort of special labels, the invisible labels we put on moral positions that are derived more especially from religious and Christian communities when they are articulated in the common public sphere. This problem is compounded by the fear of intra-religious strife, particularly due to conflicts that arise between Muslim cultures and Western liberal states, and due to the perceived necessity of a secularization model for international relations that can keep at bay the negative effects of religious violence and terrorism while making space for the very real religious pluralism that increasingly characterizes the globalized immigrant populations of modern democracies and their sustaining financial markets. You don't have homogeneous religious civilizations anymore. You've got people from Nigeria and the Philippines and Indonesia, creating urbanization, which is extremely religiously pluralistic, alongside extremely secularized liberal people. In this context, how is the Christocentrism of Gaudium et Spes meant to function meaningfully? First, Catholic Christocentrism cannot be dissolved profitably by modern theologians into a generalized religious anthropology. Been there, done that. We tried it. Here, I mean, the Catholic tradition rightly should eschew all attempts to reduce the incarnation and the uniqueness of Jesus Christ into a mere symbol of the more general processes of grace acting in all human beings, in which Christ would then become the deepest or most intensive instantiation. Jesus is the symbol of everything good happening in the world through grace. Schleiermacher, Rahner, in different ways, tried to do this, and their theologies have risked to collapse Christianity into a generalized religious anthropology. Just look at your most secular neighbor. If you stare them down hard enough, you'll see that they are, in fact, an anonymous Christian, that Christ's grace is at work in them. Every time they want to do anything that they consider good in their subjective religious consciousness, due to their fundamental option to do good and avoid evil. Right. I mean, we've worked with that model. I think it's run its course. I think that horse has gone around the track, and it didn't win any prizes. If Christ is only a particular instantiation of holiness alongside others, now we could add in a postmodern pluralistic world with the Buddha, the Quranic vision of human holiness, the different Hindu mediations, and of course all the heroes of secular modernism that help instantiate a more ethically just and inclusive society. If Jesus is one of these mediating figures, then the vision of Gaudium et Spes breaks down fundamentally. The humanism that is being promoted is centered in Gaudium et Spes on an individual person, the God-man, and the sacramental and spiritual life of his church. I don't think you can stretch the document to such a permissive interpretation that you ignore that. That being said, we might begin negatively and speak of two forms of imbalance that a right interpretation of Gaudium et Spes must avoid. Such imbalance would obtain either if one were to claim that in a post-religious age the teachings of the natural law are wholly inaccessible to human reason, save from within the domain of faith alone, and by virtue of the work of grace, or if one were to hold that the natural law can simply be read off of the climate of contemporary secularism as if the cultural progress of post-religious society should basically dictate evolving moral norms to the Catholic tradition, which in turn should assimilate them passively. I mean, you can become so Jansenistically pessimistic that you retreat into a sectarian Catholicism that believes that non-Catholics and non-Christians have no contribution to make or capacity to perceive natural norms. Or you can just basically say, well, they've won, let's assimilate, because the Holy Spirit must be working through their victory. This first stance implies an unwarranted fideism, a kind of pure grace extrinsicism, in which the church can only procure authentic humanism by breaking off from the world. The latter imbalance typically entails a progressivist capitulation to various forms of secular anti-Christian culture, a kind of Pelagian intrinsicism, where culture saves itself, and we simply need to capitulate to it. The vision of Gaudium et Spes rightly underscores that a non-religious liberalism is necessarily incomplete, wounded, and profoundly blind to the true destiny of man, but that the grace of Christ also addresses the heart of modern man by speaking directly to his own desires for happiness, moral responsibility, forgiveness, and human meaning. So there are no simple solutions to the tension between the church and the modern secular state. Modern evangelization must make manifest to human beings that their authentic salvation and enduring happiness are only made possible by life in Christ. Perhaps we might speak here not of a Benedictine option of safeguarding the light on a city set on a hill aside in a monastic setting, but of a Dominican option in which Christian communities seek to embody a culture of human life in Christ in their own internal formation, education, and prayer in local communities, but also seek to bring their witness to this life out to others in the public square to invite them to encounter Christ at the heart of the modern world. Analogously, the church has to enunciate a form of humanism within a modern context that makes room for Christian confessional identity within pluralistic cultures and in the face of secular governments. She must do so while challenging both secularists and religionists to peaceful terms of coexistence that respect the civic rights of both religious and non-religious people, and that allows for genuine open discussion between religious alternatives in accord with the differentiated consciousness of diverse citizens. In short, the church has to mediate between the extreme of a secular anti-religious mentality that would constrict religious freedom unduly and various forms of anti-liberal religious absolutism that would seek to deny de jure any possibility of civic coexistence between diverse religious and non-religious subcultures, especially through the use of religiously motivated violence and terrorism. In all these domains, no political utopianism is possible, but the principles elaborated by the pastoral constitution can be upheld in ways that are meaningful and powerful in a context very different from that in which the document was originally drafted. And so let me turn to my last section on the nature of human marriage. Gaudium et Spes contains substantive teaching on the natural and sacramental dimensions of marriage in sections 47 through 52, following after Pius XI's famous encyclical, Casti Canubi, from 1930. The document builds in many ways upon the premises of that document. Both Casti Canubi and Gaudium et Spes attempt to find a middle way that affirms on the one hand the traditional teaching that the generation and education of children is the true final end of marriage, and which affirms on the other hand the inherent meaningfulness and value of the friendship of the spouses and their shared conjugal life together. And there's a definite modern concern not to see the coupling, the conjugal life, the conjugal union and the friendship of the couple as merely instrumental or in overly physicalist terms. I mean, there's an interpersonal dimension to the relationship between spouses that's placed in, that's highlighted and given value. Now, Casti Canubi did this by speaking of diverse ends of marriage, ends in the plural, in which some are subordinate to or ordered toward others, such that the unitive dimension of the marriage might be ordered ultimately towards its procreative dimension. Gaudium et Spes famously dropped this language of multiple ends and restored instead had recourse instead arguably to the mature teaching of Aquinas, his late teaching, on marriage in the conjugal friendship of the two spouses being seen as the formal cause or essence of the marriage, while the children and their education are seen as the final cause or teleological end of the friendship. On this rendering, the friendship of the spouses and their conjugal life cannot be maintained essentially or integrally unless their conjugal life is ordered toward the transmission of life. Without the finality, the essence is compromised, at least with the intention of the finality. Metaphysically speaking, the formal cause is for or in view of the final cause, and so ethically and psychologically, the essence of a marriage changes if procreation is never intended by the union. But at the same time, if the couple wishes to have children but are involuntarily infertile, the essence of marriage is still present formally, even if this friendship cannot attain to the ultimate perfection that it aspires to. Aquinas' definition, which the pastoral constitution seems to adopt, or something like it, has the advantage of identifying a kind of relative integrity to the friendship of the spouses, while also maintaining plausibly that the goal of conceiving and raising children is at the heart of the true marital friendship and of the marital nature of the conjugal act. Gaudium et Spes was not meant to provoke controversy on the topic of marriage, even if the Council Fathers were all well aware of attempts by 19th century European states and of various 20th century communist regimes to redefine marriage civilly in a way that trampled upon the Church's teaching and sacramental authority. However, it is unquestionably the case that the teaching of the Council on this point is in the 21st century context irreducibly traditional in nature and inherently controversial. This is due not least to the widespread prevalence in modern culture of divorce as well as same-sex marriage, to say nothing of contraception. Each of these practices presumes a definition of marriage that radically contrasts with that of the Catholic tradition and of the natural law as traditionally understood. It is in this juncture that the tension between the natural law teaching in the pastoral constitution and its Christocentric doctrine of grace becomes most acutely felt and most interesting. For on the one hand, there's a clear basis in sound philosophy and in traditional Catholic theology for the affirmation that human marriage, traditionally conceived between one man and one woman for life, open to the bearing and raising of children, is an institution that is fundamentally natural to human beings, and that it is the foundation for any civic polity presupposed by the state as its genuine basis. On the other hand, in a culture in which the traditional forms of marriage are genuinely threatened and eroded existentially, can genuine human marriage be rightly understood, even rightly understood, let alone lived out effectively, without the express revelation and grace of Jesus Christ and the explicit knowledge of the mystery of the Church and the sacraments? Romans 1 suggests that when man rejects grace, he's rightly punished with blindness so that he cannot even perceive basic truths about his own human nature in relation to God and others. Actually, Paul gives the example of confusion about the ends of sexuality as the kind of idolatry that follows as a chastisement for the rejection of grace. It's incredible. Contemporary Catholic theology will continue to develop thinking precisely on this topic as the nexus of debates on nature and grace, faith and the natural law, church and state, sacrament and civic society. But we can conclude here with two central ideas. First, Aquinas' definition of the formal and final causes of marriage is of the utmost importance for any right understanding of the council in a modern context. If procreation is not the unique ultimate end of marriage, then the traditional definition of marriage and the Church's long-standing moral reflection on the subject becomes unintelligible. But because it is the case that procreation is the final end of marriage, therefore, the essence of the conjugal friendship between the spouses as married spouses must be essentially heterosexual, open to life, exclusive, and permanent. The internal logic of the Church's teaching as a rational articulation of the essence of marriage and its dignity can only be maintained if this teleological conception of marriage is rightly understood. Now, I'm not saying anything here about, you know, compassion of how we deal with all our other very wounded contemporaries who have been deeply affected by the sexual revolution, from the people who have been spousally abandoned to the divorced, to people with strong same-sex inclinations, to people living in same-sex relationships. I mean, the complexity there pastorally is immensely nuanced and very real. But you're unable to help anyone if you don't have a clear vision of the teleological orientation of human sexuality toward chastity, integration of self, and self-giving unto God and others. Second, Aquinas' doctrine of the wounds of nature is most pertinent to the consideration of this teaching within the context of a skeptical secular age. St. Thomas rightly underscores that the wounds of original sin do not obliterate the inclinations towards basic human goods, such as the good of procreation and the life of the family. I think it's actually, I know this is really trite, and I don't always read the social media, but it is interesting that George Clooney got married. A second time. It was a second marriage. But, I mean, it's interesting because he's 50. He probably has, you know, the possibility of remaining in the unmarried state with multiple partners. It seems that he's been doing that. And he chooses to give himself permanently to someone at age 50. It's just interesting to show how the people who are the most have no ideological conviction, and in fact, you might say, in some ways are so superficialized by the modern secular culture, still have an innate inclination to want to make an ultimate give themselves. Now, it may be that he didn't actually achieve what he was hoping for. We, you know, get into the question of whether that is a valid marriage. But it's interesting to see how deep the inclination is towards marriage. It's kind of amazing people still want to get married, given all the given all the ideological opposition to the normative idea. However, these inclinations can be weakened in their moral center and the intellectual perception of them as goods, both in the speculative and the practical intellect, can be deeply compromised by the indulgence of intemperate passions and the dissemination of erroneous teaching, to say nothing of the internet and the ideology of the Ivy League. If this is true, then the remedies of the false understanding of marriage in our own time are not provided by grace and faith alone, or by philosophical reason alone, but by both simultaneously. Just as the council prolongs the church's anti-Jansenist insistence on the universal hidden presence of operative grace, so it is possible to believe with Gaudium et Spes that hidden graces from Christ can accompany the church in her promotion of the natural law, helping the human mind to see the inherent natural truth. Sometimes the Holy Spirit works through philosophy. Sometimes philosophy is the conduit by which people are open to the workings of grace in their heart. It's not just one or the other. Likewise, an integral presentation of the gospel is accepted not only in faith, but invites human reason to cooperate fully with the mystery of the faith by means of a philosophically grounded understanding of the moral teachings of the Catholic Church. And so if you just teach the catechesis and even get people to practice on a deep level, but you don't give them some philosophical underpinnings, don't be surprised if their convictions about these subjects are eroded as soon as they encounter serious objections from the philosophical guild. Faith and reason work as an ellipse with two foci in which the intellect moves fluidly from one to the other, and not in a form of dialectic that would oppose revelation with natural law reasoning, placing the entire weight of the enterprise only upon one side of the polarity. So to conclude, let's return to Augustine's vision in the City of God. Gaudium et Spes marked a pivotal turn. The Catholic Church was effectively taking leave of the defensive stance adopted in previous centuries in the face of the breakdown of a unified Christendom and of the established church. However, in doing so, she was also adopting an evangelical stance in a new historical context and was making a first constructive attempt to articulate the principles of evangelical engagement for the church at the dawn of a new era. Understood in this light, the positive and optimistic tone of the document is the sign of a realism regarding the new sociological condition of the church in the modern secular world. We have to present the gospel anew in a new landscape. That the council failed to adequately predict the complete conditions and final consequences of the historical age that was unfolding is inevitable, and certainly there was naivete present. However, progressivists who cling to the council in intellectually rigid, theologically reductive ways, and traditional Catholics who utterly dismiss the document, both make essentially the same error. They believe that it was meant to provide a final comprehensive analysis of the church's mission within a modern historical context. And then based on this shared premise, they either deny aspects of its impermanence and imperfection, or they utterly dismiss it. Both those options are to take, they don't take seriously our finitude. The key is to identify the deeper Christological and anthropological content of Gaudium et Spes, its perennial principles of natural law, and its inner spiritual aspiration that the church should seek to evangelize constructively the modern world as it exists, in fact, in our own epoch. If these principles are rightly identified and preserved, the heart of the document remains of ongoing significance for the church, particularly in an era of new evangelization. Reading Gaudium et Spes in our own era might require a commitment not only to the joy and hope of the gospel signaled by that first title, but also to the second phrase of the document, Luctus et Angor, that's to say, grief and anxiety. Yeah. Joy and hope, grief and anxiety. We live both as Christians. The church today does not escape the challenge of living within the city of man, walking through a valley of tears in pilgrimage towards the city of God. Augustine's theology of history has as much pertinence today as it did during the collapse of the Roman Empire. The church militant in her earthly sojourn has no abiding home in this world. The Eucharistic sacrifice of the church's liturgy and the sacrificial life of the Christian remain the normative signs of communion with God in this world. Are we united to Christ in the sacramental life of the church? Do we seek to love others in the charity of Jesus? Are we willing to suffer for our faith and bear witness to the truth? These are the measures that are determinative for the success or failure of the Christian life in the seculum, and not those of our political influence, worldly honor, or temporal power. Ultimately, the temptation that certain readings of Gaudium et Spes bequeath to the Catholic Church is that she evaluate the success of her mission in terms that are alien to the foundations of sanctification that God wills for the Church in this world. These foundations are sacramental, and their fruit is charity lived in truth. The Church can transform the world from within due to the power of charity at work in history. But even when the world is not transformed effectively by the charity of Christ, the Church can still live her vocation in a plenary way by worshiping God, loving her neighbors in Christ, and by bearing witness to Christ unto death. Understanding this distinction is of vital importance for Catholic Christians in the 21st century. Arguably, it is only by regaining a sense of the life of the church militant as a communion of authentic charity in the midst of an increasingly non-religious world that the church can safeguard the vision of Gaudium et Spes and live it effectively in great numbers or in small, even in the midst of the pagan city of man, and always in view of the eternal city of God, a city that knows no end. Thank you.